The Capital Investment Committee hearing for April 17 is called to order. Members, we do not have a quorum, and so we'll move straight to our agenda for today. We will be hearing a few bonding bills and a few policy-related bills on an informational basis only. With that, we have Representative Scott. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. Good to see some folks I haven't seen in committees for a while. Thank you for hearing the bill today. I am new to representing East Bethel, and it seems like, I don't know, water contamination issues seem to follow me around. So we have a fresh one here in East Bethel, and the issue here is that it really affects two elementary schools. These two schools are running off of septic and their own wells, and there are some contaminants in the wells. The septic are failing. There is city sewer and water in part of East Bethel, but these schools are not hooked up to it. We need to hook them up to it. That's the reason for this bonding bill. There would be one water tower and a treatment center and all the infrastructure that goes along with that. And if I might, I would like to, Mr. Chair, turn it over to Matt Look, who is the city administrator at East Bethel that brought this issue to my attention.
Welcome, city administrator. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Matt Look, city administrator for the city of East Bethel. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this very important public health project in the North Metro. The North Metro has been home to landfills that back in the day may not necessarily have been designed to protect groundwater. Wells in East Bethel today have produced high levels of tannins, radium, manganese, and volatile organic compounds. I've included in your packet a letter from the Minnesota Department of Health identifying these concerns and their geographical location in close proximity to the two elementary schools we're talking about. Adjacent to the decommissioned Superfund landfill, you'll see the map of those two schools. And as was mentioned, they are both on well and failing septic at this point. And the reason why I'm here today is to ask for your help for the resources necessary to hook up these two elementary schools with city sewer and water utilities. The good news is we can treat the water, remove the contaminants, enhance public health and safety for the children that attend there, about 1,000 total students. The request is for bonding to complete the water lines, wells, tower, and water treatment plant. East Bethel was in news dating back to 2010 when they invested $20 million into the infrastructure necessary to hook up to the Met Council Reclamation Project or the wastewater treatment plant up there. And sewer collection system is in close proximity to these schools already, so that's part of the equation. Unfortunate reality is those bonds are going to be paid off by 2040, and the city has about 11,000 people, so bonds of this size are rather large for a city of that size. And so the advent of adding another $10 million to the bonds is probably not something that will happen anytime soon. So it's kind of a but-for test, but-for state participation in this, this project would not move forward. So certainly I'd appreciate your support on this and would stand for any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, City Administrator. Members, any discussions? So City Administrator, the only question I have, the $10.5 million request, is that for the total project cost or is that for the local share from your community?
Yeah, so that would be the total project cost for the water, wells, tower, and water lines. As far as the sewer lines already going by, that's the $20 million bond that the city has taken back in 2014. So those, again, that's half the equation, but the city has already paid for that part of it, but this is the water side of it.
Members, any additional questions?
Recording in progress.
Seeing none, any closing comments, Representative Scott?
No, just to appreciate your consideration for this important project. I appreciate your time, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing the bill.
Thank you. Next on the agenda, House File 5351, Chair Vane. So not seeing Chair Vane, we'll move on to the next item of the agenda. And then we have Vice Chair Ryer, House File 5203. And as Vice Chair Ryder moves up, I understand you have a A1 amendment for reference. Welcome, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee and members. First of all, I would like to explain the amendment that's in your packet. This amendment is very simple. It replaces page 2, line 29, replaces the day following final enactment with the date July 1, 2024, to make the timing of establishing the program and the funding compatible. So this project, House File 5203, establishes and funds a new program for accessibility-focused capital investments on state-owned property. In the work we do here in the Capital Investment Committee, we see so many requests and so much need for investment across Minnesota, especially for asset preservation. And many of the sites we visit on bonding tours have accessibility upgrades as part of their need. Amidst the competition for bonding funds, it seemed that requests that would provide better access for people with disabilities often don't rise to the top. This program is suggested to provide dedicated resources for those needs. The bill sets standards for eligible projects and usage of funds, outlines procedures for the Department of Administration, and requires an annual report. $10 million is requested to fund this account. I'd also like to note that the administration has come forward with a similar program using general funds. As they say in their request, the purpose is to provide financial assistance to state agencies so they can better address the facility needs of their employees and public visitors. By improving the physical access to state government facilities, this program will also improve the independence and productivity of Minnesotans with disabilities. I look forward to working with the Department of Administration to bring our two proposals together. None of us are getting younger, and as my friends and I have gotten older, it's become more vivid and more personal that accessibility improvements benefit us all. And I want to thank all of the advocates who are working for better disability access. I'm grateful for your input and sharing of experiences. And now I'd like to turn it over to Trevor Turner for his thoughts on the bill.
Welcome, Director. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Trevor Turner, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. And I'm here to show our support for House File 5203. I want to thank Representative Ryer for bringing this bill and to bring an opportunity for us to talk about access in our state government. I personally believe that the best form of government is the most participatory government. And I think that that can only happen if everyone has equal access to the government institutions and buildings in our state agencies. This fund would establish a centralized fund that our state agencies, especially those that are small agencies and smaller commissions and councils who do not have the funding necessarily to fix some of the ADA requirements in their buildings and offices. And so I think that would be a lot of help for our smaller agencies for that thing. And then this will also increase, enhance public access and employment opportunities for people with disabilities. The Council on Disabilities has had employees who were not able to access some of the HR buildings for their onboarding processes because they were not accessible. They didn't have a proper wheelchair ramps or elevators, functioning elevators and things like that. So this will go a long way to helping employees with disabilities as well who work with our state agencies. I was pleased to see that there's a possibility for future adjustments based on, as need as we see fit. I think this initial funding will go a long way, and I hope that we can continue to have this fund available on an ongoing basis. And of course, ADA compliance in government buildings is not just a legal requirement, but is a fundamental human right. And I think ensuring accessibility for all, regardless of disability, upholds the principle and equality of non-discrimination. And finally, I believe that this sets a precedent for the private sector as well. I think that when our state government is a model for accessibility and ensuring access to everyone that many of our private sector companies and all companies and nonprofits and things like that will follow suit as well. So the Minnesota Council on Disability is excited to review and recommend the project approvals, and we look forward to assisting our state agencies to ensure accessibility for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Members, any questions? Seeing none, closing comments. Representative Ryer.
Well, I have this bill because every Minnesotan stands to benefit from greater accessibility, especially when it comes in the form of state-funded projects and capital improvements. So I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Next, the agenda, we'll go back to Chair Vane, House File 5351. Welcome, Chair Vane. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill requests $3 million in bonding dollars to the Brooklyn Center to support their efforts in revitalizing the city, specifically on the Opportunity site, which is about 80 acres. Currently, much of the site is vacant, but before any buildings can be built on top, it needs infrastructure to support the bones of the development, such as utility improvements, stormwater, road construction, and other necessary improvements before further developing a vacant lot. And with me here is the city manager, Reggie, who can also provide further details to the bill.
Chairman, before we go to the city manager, I understand you have the A1 amendment. Can you explain that just for reference?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment, which deletes the second section of the bill. This relates to dollars to a nonprofit faith in communities. And however, due to the budget limitations this year, we feel it's appropriate to take that out for the time being.
Thank you. Welcome, City Manager. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dr. Reggie Edwards. I serve as the City Manager for the City of Brooklyn Center. So first, let me say, Mr. Honorable Chair Lee and committee members, thank you for taking the time to hear our request, and also Representative Vang for introducing this bill and for all the work that you do in Brooklyn and for Brooklyn Center. Brooklyn Center is a community with a great deal of need. The community has experienced significant disinvestments over the last several decades, which has led to the erosion of its tax base. The Opportunity site will expand Brooklyn Center's entire tax base and provide benefits to the entire region. As you consider this request from Brooklyn Center, please keep in mind a few facts. Brooklyn Center is the most diverse city in the state of Minnesota, with 64% of our population of the residents are people of color, and a quarter are foreign-born. Brooklyn Center has the lowest median income in the region and has the highest property tax rate in Hennepin County. Our residents pay more for the exact same services residents at a higher rate than our surrounding suburb cities. This is an issue of economic resiliency that affects the entire region. Yet despite this, Brooklyn Center is rich in cultural diversity and has a strong entrepreneur spirit. We are home to more small business per capita than any other suburban city in Hennepin County. The 80-acre Opportunity Site redevelopment area is the most significant development for the city of Brooklyn Center, and is rare given its the large number of available acres to develop as well as access to the highway. The city has made significant investments in the acquisition and demolition of properties in the site to achieve our redevelopment goal. The entire project will bring more than 4,000 new units of housing and up to 130,000 square feet of retail space and 400,000 square feet of employment opportunities. The project will expand Brooklyn Center's entire tax base by 12%. The goals of the Opportunity Site is to create a downtown center and signature destination, as it offers green space and has amenities that will drive the city's economic growth as well as serving the entire region. I would say that phase one of the Opportunity Site is 15-acre planned development that will include 700 mixed-income housing, locally-oriented commercial business spaces, an event center, community-based entrepreneur hub, outdoor market, and public gathering spaces. The macroeconomic changes and rising interest rates had led to the project's funding gap. for the infrastructure. Without additional funding for the public infrastructure, the phase one and development across Opportunity Site will remain infeasible. Brooklyn Center believes that phase one will be a catalyst for future development throughout the Opportunity Site and across the city. So again, Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank you for the time to speak to you. I'll stand for questions that you may have.
Thank you, City Manager. Representative Scrava.
Thank you, Chair Lee, City Manager. So this $3 million investment is going to spur a dollar amount. I heard you say it's going to have housing, all these other things, just a ballpark. I don't need a tight number. Because, you know, if three helps bring 50 or 60, it's a very worthy project. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
City Manager.
Yes, Chairman Lee, committee member, we anticipate that phase one with the 15 acres, that $80 million, investment 80 acres would generate approximately $240 million in redevelopment.
Chair Lee, thank you. Very good project. Yeah. Thank you.
Members, any additional questions? So, City Manager, I do have just a quick question for you. So I know that I think, you know, being a neighbor to your south, I really appreciate you guys bringing this forward. And so I know that the former Target site, I think there's some funding from the state for that for a nonprofit. And so how would this vision impact that site and what they're trying to do there with some funds from the state already?
Okay. Madam Chair, the Opportunity Site expands across 8 acres, extending from the southern end of this particular area to the northern, going towards the highway. And that nonprofit and the Target site is within the footprint, if you will, of the Opportunity Site. So it's all part of the development.
Okay, thank you. I see no other questions. Closing comments, Chair Vane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just want to thank you for the committee's time and for your support. This is a good and important bill for the city, so I appreciate the committee's support.
Thank you, Chair Vane. Next on the agenda, we have Vice Chair Ryer again, you know, with House File 5312. And Vice Chair Ryer, as you move up, I understand you have a A1 amendment for reference. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee and members. I do indeed have an amendment, the A1 amendment. This takes a provision from the Chapter 71 from last year that authorized the report for this, the report that we're seeing as the basis for the legislation today. We had allocated $304,000 for that. We are adding a provision from lines 2.4 to 2.7 that says upon completion of development of the recommendations, remaining funds may be utilized to begin implementation of the recommendations. And so I would propose that we pass this amendment so that the remaining funds can go to the project budget.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Ryer. Please proceed.
So the bill before you today represents results from a progression of work to update Minnesota's sustainability guidelines and processes. And this is a program that dates back to 2001. My first bill dates back to March of 2021 and focused on adding resiliency guidelines to help adapt state buildings to projected climate-related changes. And since we did not pass a bonding bill during that biennium, these changes did not move forward. In February of 2023, the Office of the Legislative Auditor issued an evaluation report that critiqued program oversight and administration and issued a set of recommendations to improve the program. This report was presented to this committee last session. As a follow-up to the OLA report, funding was included in the 2023 bonding bill for the Department of Administration to contract with the University of Minnesota's Center for Sustainable Building Research, or CSBR, to develop recommendations based on the findings in the OLA report. This report is provided in your packets and online. These years of effort culminate in House File 5312 before you today. The bill language was developed through close collaboration between admin and CSBR, and I'm pleased to have been part of that successful work effort. The bill defines a robust structure with clear accountability, support, and defined processes that enable our sustainability program to fully achieve its goals. As a result, we will have state-funded buildings that are more energy efficient, sustainable, resilient, and adaptable, and are good places for employees to work. Richard Graves from CSBR will now provide more detailed information about the bill.
Welcome, Director. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee, Vice Chair Ryer, and members of the committee. My name is Richard Graves, and I'm the Director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. CSBR developed updates, provides technical assistance, and works with project teams for the Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines program, also known as B3, for the Departments of Administration and Commerce. The program was created by the legislature in 2001 and has been updated many times. The program involves a number of parts from the guidelines that are used in capital construction projects for new, renovated, and projects that are both combinations of new and renovations. The SB 2030 Energy and Carbon Standard is used by us for the requirements of B3 and is also used as the Energy and Carbon Standard by a number of municipalities all across Minnesota as part of their sustainability ordinances or green building ordinances. And then finally, B3 also tracks energy usage, provides operations improvement processes, and conducts post-occupancy evaluations on existing buildings and completed B3 projects. During its 21-year history, over 4,000 people have worked on B3 projects all across the state. We've had, now it's actually more than 500 projects have enrolled in the program at various phases of design, construction, and occupancy. These projects are located across Minnesota and range from large stadiums, multifamily housing, park buildings, transit stations, et cetera. And together, these buildings are estimated to be saving millions of BTUs of annual energy savings. Which translates into quite a bit of carbon savings, and then in addition, a savings of over $18 million per year in energy savings, with over $100 million of energy savings for the projects in the program over the life of the program. In addition, over 10,000 projects and public buildings are tracking their operational energy use through the B3 benchmarking program. And that helps a variety of public and private sector building owners run their buildings more efficiently. So in the last session, as Representative Ryer outlined, the legislature requested a report with recommendations for the program. CSBR worked with the Department of Administration to deliver the report on October 15th, 2023, in response to the OLA recommendations. The report made recommendations in the following areas: updating program goals and measuring performance, the applicability of B3 for projects, providing tracking compliance and providing waivers for projects as a whole or individual parts of the guidelines, outreach and training, administration of the program, and then finally resources and support needed to kind of update and carry the program into the future. So the process that we used to put together the report last summer to prepare for delivering the report in October, we surveyed over 2,500 people from the B3 listserv, AIA Minnesota's membership list, and other channels. We held four focus groups with design teams and contractors, state agencies, and other owners, advocacy groups, and then an integrated group for people who may have missed a focus group. In addition, we had additional meetings with stakeholders to address representation gaps for people we didn't reach through the survey and the focus groups. This included design teams in Greater Minnesota, contractors in Greater Minnesota, small design teams, contractors and owners of nonprofit and municipal projects, subcontractors, suppliers, trade associations, environmental groups, green building organizations, and then state agencies and labor unions. So the findings from the report were that the existing statutes have not been updated for the administration of the Sustainable Building Guideline Program, that the statutes are complicated and confusing for the requirements, whether a project needs to use B3 or not. In addition, the statutes do not include any ability for the Department of Administration or us working with them to include education, training, compliance tracking, and waiver and scope determinations, which are all essential to running the program. In addition, we found through all of the outreach that many project owners do not understand their responsibilities in the program and really rely heavily on their design teams to basically tell them what to do, which creates challenges in getting project approvals from owners, from design teams, et cetera, et cetera. In addition, the funding has not been updated for inflation, so the funding that was provided to the program in 2001 has remained flat over the life of the program, which allows us to do less and less each year. And then finally, the B3 program provides many benefits for not only state construction, but the broader design and construction industry in Minnesota. So the bill before you, HF 5312, addresses the recommendations from the October report by updating the statutes to have the Department of Administration oversee and administer the program, which addresses the accountability, waivers, and scope determinations that we found were challenges. It also allows for compliance tracking and reporting. In addition, the project definitions are updated to streamline the goals and applications of B3 to projects. This is done by having a common definition of a new building and a renovated building, so it's one definition for every project type, which will simplify things. It also includes a 10,000 square foot project minimum size, which will help reduce some of the smaller projects and the administrative burden for those projects while still having an impact, you know, the sustainability and resilience impact we're looking for. It also includes a review and future updates to the guidelines to refine and simplify the guidelines for some areas where we think we can reduce the number of guidelines, refine them, and still keep making the impact that we're making. And then, in addition, reporting key performance indicators to a revised set of legislative goals. And then finally, the bill includes adding the ability to do education training and creating compliance tools to support project owners and design teams to be more successful. This will include us, this will give us the ability to do online education and training by project role, new education and training for project owners so they understand their responsibilities and their role as roles in projects, and then bringing first-time participants in the B3 program up to speed so they know what to do and can be successful. So thank you, Chair Lee, Vice Chair Ryer, and members of the committee. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Director Graves, for the presentation on the updated report and the language that we have before us. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ryer and Director Graves. Are there additional costs by using this? And more importantly, is the technology and the product availability, is it to make these buildings? Because a lot of times what comes out of the idea doesn't hit the real market for years, you know. So I'm just curious, are there any extra costs and availability of the product?
Dr. Grace.
Representative, that's a good question. So additional costs, and quite frankly, that's why the bill allowing us to get a better handle on and get better reporting from project teams on costs would help us track that. Mm-hmm. We've done a number of studies over the years to try to get to, you know, exactly what the additional costs are. Generally, with a limited amount of projects, it's 1-3% additional costs. But again, expanding that out to be able to track it across multiple project types, locations all across the state, would allow us to have a more robust tracking of that. The program, and particularly the energy part of the program, is where you run into those technology barriers or potential cost increases. And the program includes a payback analysis that has to occur. And so if a measure doesn't pay back within a 12-year payback, is the current way that's defined, teams don't have to do that. I will say what we often find, and this is part of that project owner education,
yep.
Many owners don't understand that, so they're not kind of going through and really doing kind of a comprehensive analysis, and they might think they have to do an expensive strategy, and then the more we can work with them, we can find out, no, that actually, from a cost payback perspective, you don't have to do that, and here's an alternative compliance path. So,
Representative Scrava.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. The other question I have is, what bill would this appropriation be included in?
Representative Ryder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scrava, it would be in our bonding bill.
All right. Thank
Representative
you.
Representative Scrava.
Thank you. That's good. Thank you, Chair.
Members, any additional questions? Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Graves, if individuals that are have bonding projects or are looking at potential bonding projects, would they directly contact you or about the plan for the B3, making sure that they're reaching it or that they're not over, you know, that they're not putting too much B3 that they don't need?
Dr. Graves.
Representative, good question. I mean, first they work through the Department of Administration process to do a pre-design, which tells them they need to factor in B3 and the cost when they're putting costs in for a bonded project. Many teams, when they're going through that, will have a meeting or a workshop with us where we go through and kind of verify the costs and their approach. And we can kind of catch things or make recommendations. But I will say, you know, many teams don't do that at all and kind of go ahead and we catch them after the fact, which I think is one of the real challenges which this bill addresses, which is to catch these project teams in the beginning so that we can start to work with them and kind of everything is reviewed and integrated into their projects from the beginning, both on the design side but also on the owner side.
Representative Franzen.
No.
Members, any additional questions? Representative Erdahl.
I don't have any on this one. I will later, so do check on me. I don't know how to raise my hand here.
And so, members, with that, just do want to note for the record that both Representative Erdahl and Representative Carroll is joining us virtually for this committee hearings. And, you know, I really appreciate that question, Representative Franzen. I think that, you know, if we have a bonding process in place, that I will hope that, you know, not just local units of government too, but, you know, nonprofits, whoever, they go through, you know, department administration with the pre-designed design so that we can actually on the back end about the funding and really understand what projects is in front of us. And so really appreciate you raising that for us so that any project, whether that's this requirement or any other requirements that we have in state law, is understood by projects proposers before they ask for funding from the state. So really thank you. Say thank you to you, Dr. Graves, for coming up with this report to capture all of that. Any closing comments, Representative Ryder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the attention to this and just want to note that what we've been able to do is take the experience of the past 20 years, learn from it, and put recommendations in place that will help us do this important work better. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryder. Members, so the next two items of the agenda is both of my bills, and so I ask Vice Chair Ryder to come take the chair and I'll go up there.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Let's start with House File 5287. I understand you have an amendment coded H5287-A1 for reference. Can you identify yourself for the record? Explain your amendment and your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A1 amendment just further clarifies the nonprofits that if they were to receive funding from the bonding bill, then you know this is making sure that we're just targeting those from the bonding bill and not any other nonprofits from other grants through other state agencies. And this was something that was brought forth by MMB. And so to the bill before us, I think, you know, the House research memo really explained it. I think, you know, for me, as we travel across the state, when we hear from local communities about the different projects that they have, whether that's on tours or in the committee, they talk about, you know, what is the project total project cost, what is the local share, where the other fundings are coming from. And so what the bill does is to further clarify saying that the non-state share, as what we currently have right now, you know, applies to both, you know, local projects and capital projects, and that this include any state assistance in any matter that includes direct appropriations, grant programs, award, or any combination of state assistance appropriate and granted by other state entities. And I think some of the examples, if I have not shared in the past, is, you know, when we're hearing from projects that are receiving LCCMR dollars, they're coming for bonding dollars as an LCC, they're using LCCMR as the match. You know, we are hearing from projects that are getting funding from legacy, and they're saying that the legacy dollars are being a match. And then I think, you know, one example that we heard here, and I asked the PFA, what about some of these grant programs with the PFA, is that considered a state match or whatnot? And I think the discussion was that, yes, that's going towards that match that we have too. And so I want to make it clear that at least the standard for us is that we have a local share, and we as legislators, should we choose, when we create and craft our bonding bill, we could have exceptions. You know, we just need to write it out in the language. And so the standard would just be that there's a local share at 50% or so, and then after that, you know, shall we choose as a body to make an exception to that, then we could write that into the language. And so that's what we have in front of us today.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Representative Scrappa.
Chair Ryer and Chair Lee, I'm hearkening back to my mayoring days when we had a $9 million project and PFA was in it, PSIC was in it, everybody was in it, and our match was what we could afford, and it wasn't half, it wasn't even close. And I think it's your comment about, or if you can put it in either legislation or everyone in the pipe has to understand, some communities can't afford 50%, you know, and but they're putting their skin in it, you know what I'm saying? They're putting something in it that they're willing to, if all they do is X and they're asking for a bigger number, their little bit means something, at least to me it does, that they're trying, but they're coming to the state for help, and their cause is a good cause. So at first blush, I agree with you that, you know, the 50% for the nonprofits, unless this board or whoever puts in there saying they can't handle the 50%. You know, it's not, and they're using LCCMR money and help me with that. Are you saying that if a project uses, let's say $1 million project, 500,000 comes from bonding, capital investments, 500 comes from LCCMR. Does one match the other, or does that not match then?
Surely.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scrabble. For, you know, just to that example, I think that we need to acknowledge that LCCMR is state dollars too. And so when we do that project that you're providing as an example, then that's 100% state share without any contribution at the local level.
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And adding on to what Representative Scrappa was saying, I feel like on line 1.18, the original language says if they have very low average net capacity, a state share could be more than half. So I think existing law does cover it. But one thing I have to say about this session, I had no idea how much I agreed with Representative Lee on how we should do some of these bonding things. The number of requests we get is outrageous. As we talked about your last portion, I think that was down the right path. This is something that I've thought many times to myself. This is exactly how we should be doing it, because we have to find ways to, one, incentivize local communities or nonprofits or anything to come up with as much as they can. Because as much as we'd love to help all the good causes in the world, we have $70 billion of requests or some insane number. So I think this is a great way to do it, and I like this in addition to that other bill.
Representative Leader Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Lee. I appreciate the discussion on the process, trying to find ways to make it better. We've got a lot of well-intentioned suggestions that come out there from both sides of the aisle, many of which make it more difficult to put this together, frankly. But we have to be careful on the impact. I mean, what I'm concerned about are those that just don't have the funds and can't proceed unless we give them over 50%. And I'm glad, apparently, that Representative Lee has the provision in here that we can make adjustments to that. But, you know, I'm concerned, for example, let's say that a town, in order to reach the limit, has to increase their levy. So they increase their levy, and now they've got it, but then they don't get it approved. So they've essentially raised their taxes, not knowing if they're going to be able to use that tax increase or not. So I think these are things that, you know, we can be looking at, and always with the ramifications of what we're doing kept in mind. I was wondering if Director Freeman is around, if he had any comments on this.
Leader Dahl, he is around. He's coming down to the table.
Thank you.
Just realized you might not be able to see that.
No.
Director Freeman, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Jeff Freeman, the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. In regard to Representative Erdahl's, well, I guess I'm not quite clear how this bill would affect PFA program funding. So PFA WIF grants and PSIG grants are up to 80% of total project costs. WIF grants, for example, based on affordability, before we award a grant, we look closely at community rates and revenues to support their water or wastewater system, making sure that they have the revenue to support the O&M, pay existing debt service, and pay the local share of the new project. Oftentimes that means that a community has to increase rates even when we're providing a grant, sometimes $50, $60, $70 a month or more for the wastewater or the water system to receive the grant and build the project. And most of the projects that we fund do not receive additional state direct appropriations. We're funding the project based on the 80% grant and then the low interest PFA loan for the balance. So I'm not quite clear how this would affect that, but I would be concerned that communities that meet the WIF affordability just would not be able to afford. If we had to cut grant back to 50%, that would be very difficult.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Chair Lee, any comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think to that point, you know, I am conscious that we are doing that. And I think what we're seeing as the real life example before us is that communities are saying that PSID, you know, the PFA and grants like that are the match to what they're asking from us for direct appropriations. And I think, you know, like what I'm saying, this is the standard, this is the floor that, you know, we require a local contribution. And I think, you know, more to the administration of the program, we could continue to work should this language move forward with the Public Facilities Authority to not impact that. But I think what we're trying to get here is this is the standard that there's a local contribution. And, you know, to the effect that, you know, I think to Representative Scraba's point, we have the ability as legislators to put in language to notwithstand the statute should we want to put in more than 50%. You know, for example, we have the capital assistance program through the MPCA. Last year, we have a direct appropriation to a community that's more than 50%, so we put in that language or above the cap. And so I think we still, as legislators, have tools. I think what we're proposing here is just the floor, and kind of going back to Representative Franson's point earlier about the B3 program, that we set the standards that projects understand on the front end, what is the expectation, and sure, they still move along the process. We can make that determination along the process as we consider projects for funding.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Leader Adalter, do you have any additional questions?
Well, just yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and then very, very quickly. I do appreciate and not opposed to, you know, looking at the process, but we do have to make sure that the ramifications are understood, what their implications are. I do not want to harm the small towns of greater Minnesota from getting projects because of changes we make. But again, let's make sure that we understand the ramifications. I think that Director Freeman needs to digest this a little bit more as well. Let's look at, trying to do some things that are going to work to make the process better, again, with an eye toward the ramifications and unintended consequences that might be there.
Madam Chair, real quickly. So I think to that point, you know, this is not trying to get after the small towns or big cities. I think the example that I use in my own city right now, the city of Minneapolis is coming forward for a $44 million bridge that they want us to consider for funding at the full amount. And I think that, you know, having a standard for all of us is that the city of Minneapolis should have a share, at least, you know, with this language, 50%. And that will be up to us at the legislature if we want to give them more or less than 50%. And so I want to let you all know on the record that this is a standard that I want to set for everybody, because we have the hard decision to make, and that's why I really appreciate the feedback from Representative West, that we have to look beyond our individual communities and see how could we be good stewards of the public's dollars as we put in our budgets together.
Chair Lilly.
Madam Chair, could I just quickly respond to that?
Leader Duff.
Thank you. Yeah, I do not. I'm not implying that anyone is trying to, you know, get at smaller Minnesota cities. I'm, you know, just I agree with the chair about, you know, the need to look on this in a statewide manner, but again, making sure that the implications are carried out as we intend them to be.
Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Lee, for bringing this forward for discussion. It's I have to be full disclosure as Chair of Legacy. I continue to find this, you know, just interesting. It's and I, you know, being on this committee, I know, you know, we had PFA just up, and then, you know, they get money through Legacy, they get money through here, and, you know, I'm not on Chair Hansen's committee, but I follow, you know, to a certain extent what they're working on. And so a lot of, especially in the environmental space, you know, you'll have groups that get LCCMR grants, they'll get legacy money, they might get clean water funds within my, you know, our funds, or Lessard SAMs, and they kind of, or through bonding, and they'll kind of put together projects. And then you also add in federal money. So is that local buy-in? And then should there be local buy-in maybe in a, you know, in a wetland restoration, necessarily, maybe not. I don't know. But, and so it's always, I think the discussion is really good. I'm a little, you know, I think of the groups that are trying to put these pieces together, whether it be a DNR or, you know, different organizations around the state that ask for funds. I think they're trying to collaborate. You know, it's a little like puzzle pieces. They're trying to restore a prairie, and it's kind of shocking how many different funding and then, you know, that are right next to each other. There's a lot of actual collaboration between the federal government, you know, on fish and game money, and then, you know, a trail might go through there that, you know, might be LCCMR or, you know, even through mine or your, you know, so it's all complicated. And but I still think it's good to ask the questions, and I wish I knew. It's shocking to me how many of, I wish I knew every, you know, like it was just funded by, whether it be like my committee, it'd be funded by Lessard Sams, the whole entire project. But so many of the projects, the good work that we see around the state is really merged of, you know, so many, whether state things or federal or, you know, nonprofits that are doing work around the state. So, no, I'm glad to discuss it. It's a little embarrassing that I don't have the answers. You know, we on your committee, we toured that one prairie restoration, the wetland, and the one that we happened to be on that day was actually Lessard Sams, remember, during the rain. And but you know, the same sort of projects done through the funding that comes through this committee, too. So there's really no difference. It's just another, you know, restoration in a different category. So I'm not really, I don't have an answer, but I certainly support the discussion and looking at it. So I'm glad you are. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Lilly, for those comments. And I think if you look at the language, you know, line 1.13 to 1.15, we are accounting for the non-state shares, you know, that could be federal, local, private, or other funds, or a combination of that, to acknowledge that, you know, what I'm trying to get at is the non-state sources to make sure that we acknowledge that other pots of money from state government, whether that's LCCMR, legacy, or whatnot, are still state sources. And I think kind of, you know, building off of what you're saying, you know, projects like that have multiple sources of funding. You know, on the flip side, we look at communities that don't have projects that fit those criteria. Bonding might be the only option. Capital investment might be the only option for them to get funding. And so I think, you know, we need to think beyond just this, but like, is that a fair consideration for those communities that we are the only options? The example I used before, I think DNR have several pots of money that they could go after, but Department of Corrections, I think we're the only funding source for them for their capital needs. And so, you know, just to ask all of us to consider, you know, there are some projects that get different capital funding for sources for capital, but others don't. And so just want to leave at that for all of you to think about as we continue to work on this going forward.
Representative Grassel.
Thank you, Chair Ryder. Chair Lee, I guess I think I heard the answer to one of my questions in there. Is this going to push projects that are questionable for bonding to their in the appropriate direction for the committee or the other sources of funding?
Chair Lee.
Thank you, you know, Representative Grasso. I think that's a good question, and you know, I don't think I have the answer for that. And I think, you know, what I am trying to get at is just setting that standard, and should they still want to come forward. I think this is not precluding them from coming forward, but it's just a standard of, you know, can you think about other pots of money that if you're looking for help from the state, at least from the state, if this is passed into law, that, you know, we will have the expectation of we will contribute 50%, you think about the other half. And if, you know, to those the points that's made loud and clear earlier, if the community cannot afford more than 50% or 50% of the project, we still have an ability as the legislature to put in language to notwithstand this requirement and put in more money into that project going forward too.
Representative Grassel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just one more, I guess, is this going to help us to control debt growth, and will it help us, or and will it also help us to bring debt down?
Chair Lee.
That's a good question, Representative Grassel. I can't answer that at the moment, but I think what I will hope is that, you know, we will look at, you know, funding 50% of projects going forward if we want to, as we consider funding, and so that there's that expectation that we're not going to fully fund a particular project, you know, like the example in my community for the Minneapolis Bridge, that we could consider funding some portion of that, but we're not going to take on all the debt and all the funding for that bridge, and so you need to put some skin in the game too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, I mean, that's if we can, I'm sure you're just like I do, just like me, is that I don't want to take my credit card and run the son of a gun up to the limit and keep paying debt after debt after debt. Yeah. So thank you.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Lee. I think I want to focus in on the layering where you see money from bonding and then money from another state source and another state source. You know, it could be deed grants. It could be a variety of things that come together, and then all of a sudden there's 100% and there's no local participation. And we have seen an explosive growth of capital projects over the last 10 years in LCCMR. And so that's why we adopted policies to have the same type of criteria for bonding as the bonding projects where they have to show, because that would be a way to bypass bonding if you get it into a place where it only needs a 50% vote to pass versus a supermajority. So it is a real issue in terms of layering things up. And then so then it's skill of or who has representation here rather than just any of the communities that are throughout our state. And that leads to unfairness. So I think this is a good effort to make sure that at least there's some local participation. And even on the capital projects that we would have in LCCMR, we said there has to be some local participation, and they can't layer it back.
Truly.
And just real quickly to that end, too, I think that, you know, it's fair for us to consider. Let's say that they get 25% from LCCMR, then for the Capital Investment Committee to consider that 25 remaining 25%. And so just wanted to make it clear that I think, you know, the standard we want to set is 50%, and whether that's, you know, if you're going to layer, like what Representative Hansen said, that, you know, we take that into consideration as the legislature when we look at these projects, and just having that standard of, okay, if 10% is coming from bonding, 10% from LCCMR, and then the remaining 30% could possibly come from legacy or whatnot. And I think that's just what we want to get at about the non-state share being from non-state sources.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Lee. I'm thinking about my district, and I'm thinking about a trail. And a trail comes, it comes with a, it seems to be more and more trails now are being developed by nonprofits, snowmobile clubs, ATV clubs, biking, hiking clubs, and the city is the sponsor, or a county is a sponsor. And it's a public trail, you know, sort of, it's all public. But so an ATV club comes in and petitions the DNR and says, we want to do a trail here. And then the money, oh, how are you going to pay for it? And the DNR says, well, we can give you X. And then they come to the legislator and say, can you get me some money for this? And then we come here. And in the end, this is the hard part that I have trying to understand this. In the end, it's a public's. It's all public. There's no private, no one benefits here privately, because we're doing it for everyone, you know, these trails. So I'm trying to wrap my head around, other than putting a rider on the bill saying no public match, like at the end of some of these bonding requests, no public match requested or authorized, whatever the wording is. So then it lets this group off from that. Is that going to be enough to satiate this this addition?
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scraba. You know, I think this ties back to other bills that we had before us, and trying to get to this too. And if you guys remember last year, I brought a similar bill for around non-state contribution. I think, you know, that I don't want to speak for MMB, but, you know, from just working with MMB in the past, what they really look at for projects and, you know, to really release the funding to those public projects, whether that's, you know, a nonprofit organization or a public entity, is do they have the full funding? I think that's what matters for the capital dollars that's coming in place. And so, like I said, this is going towards setting that standards. And I think to your point, you know, maybe we don't want to, you know, have those right of language. But I think what we're trying to do here, and what we have seen in the past, you know, myself and I think Representative Erdahl, when he was chair too, we have put in more than 50% for a particular project. But I think this is the standard that I want to set for all of us so that everybody knows before they're coming to the state and whether that's the, you know, the legislature's prerogative if they want to fund more or less than 50% of that.
Right, thank you. Thank you, Chair. Chairs.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Or, Madam Speaker, maybe someday. Madam Chair. Madam Chair. Mr. Chair. Question. So we know that there's a lot of wants that come through us. We saw many of those wants on the bonding trip, and then we know that there's needs out there, especially when the state is saying, for example, we'll use the MPCA with phosphorus and nitrate levels, right? What I don't want to see is those needs, especially if it's mandated by the state, being hampered by a 50%. And I hear you saying we can negotiate that level. But my gut itself, once something is passed into statute, depends on who's, once it leaves our hands, the department has a tendency to read into things and do their own rulemaking, making things sometimes more difficult for us that we didn't intend, right? So what ideas do you have to make sure that the needs of our states aren't hampered by the department or just negative implications that might come by?
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Representative Ryer, and thank you, Representative Franzen. I think that is a good discussion point that is beyond what we're trying to achieve here. And I think that, you know, if you want to have that conversation, I'm more than willing to have that conversation on. I think, you know, I wouldn't disagree with the comments that you have made. You know, oftentimes when we at the legislature have appropriate funding and it gets out there, how the agency, you know, read the intent of the legislation that we pass. I think oftentimes, you know, I myself have disagreed with agencies too. And so would love to touch base if you want to, you know, after this, how could we really work together to really make sure that the intent of the legislature is reflective of what was passed and signed into law.
Chair Lee, any closing comments?
Just want to say thank you all members for a robust discussion, and this is heard on informational basis only. And, you know, as we move along in the process, I think that it is good to acknowledge the valid point that, you know, Director Friedman brought forth with the PFA, and we really want to make sure that whatever we do here doesn't impact, you know, programs like that going forward, but still acknowledge that, you know, beyond that particular program, there's a standard of, let's say, we need a local contribution. So thank you for the robust discussion.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Next up, our last bill for today. Again, Chair Lee, House File 5384. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 5384. I think, as you may have seen on the tour, I think what really gets to me that we see here is a lot of the contribution through Chair Legacy and the Legacy Committee and the commitment that they have made across the state. I think this was an idea brought forth from my counterpart from the other body to really acknowledge that the state have put in some contribution into these projects. And, you know, regarding costs, I don't know how much cost this will be, but I will hope that it's not a lot. And, you know, just wanted to bring this forth as a point of discussions for us to consider, shall we want to follow the path of the Legacy Committee and just acknowledge that the state of Minnesota have made a contribution to that particular project.
Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Lee. I think it's a great idea. It makes a lot of sense because I think you know, the Environmental Trust Fund does some signage and legacy, and it's in, and I think there is a value for the taxpayers to know and where, you know, how the projects come about, and so I very much support this effort.
Chair Pulowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chairman Lee, is this retroactive? I've got 38 years of projects I'd like to identify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As of right now, it's not retroactive. And, you know, if this is going to move along the process. If there's an interest in doing so, I think we could consider that.
Representative Scraba.
Back to Chair and Chair Lee, back to one of the questions that Chair Lilly, I sit on Legacy Environment and here, so some days I can't remember which committee I heard the bill on, because sometimes they're in all of them, and I'm like, where did I hear that? So being new to this, sometimes it's overwhelming trying to figure out all this funding, but getting to the sign thing, one thing we do at the IRRRB up in Iron Range is when it's an IRRRB project, we want them to put a sign up there. And it makes a difference. People recognize it. It becomes like, oh, where'd that come from? Oh, there. Then look it up. It's amazing how the public does that. And, you know, as much information as you can get on that sign, at some point they will use it. So it's a good idea. And now that I'm on Legacy, I walk around the state looking for that little Legacy thing, and it's everywhere. I mean, it's everywhere. And it's good to see that those dollars are being used everywhere I go. So I think it's, you know, and again, the cost, I don't know if you have a standard yet, like different organizations have a standard. This is the size we want or need. I don't know if you've gotten that far in the down the rabbit hole yet, you know, and where it goes, does it go on the building, does it go next to the building, and all that stuff. It does play into the project, but I think the idea is there, and I think it's a good idea. Thank you.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scraba, for those remarks. I don't really have a standard in place right now. I think this is what's prescribing in front of us. Like I said, if it moves forward, then we'll make sure that, you know, we get input from all of the members on this committee, and I think for all of us in the legislature. And I would just note that there's 34 other spots for authorship, and we appreciate any co-authors on this bill as we move forward.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Any further closing comments? Okay. All right, so members, I'd like to give you a roadmap for the committee. First, we're not meeting next Monday, April 22nd, due to the legislative recess. Our next meeting is Wednesday, April 24th, and we'll hear more bills on an informational-only basis. The tentative plan is to vote a bonding bill out of committee on Wednesday, May 1st. We'll follow the standard practice with a posted DE amendment, walkthrough, public testimony, then markup and vote. Public notice will be emailed and posted as the schedule gets finalized. And that concludes our hearing for today. The meeting is adjourned. Pardon? Representative Franzen.
Could you remind us what the what we're looking at for a total bonding dollar amount, and then local project dollar amount? And I assume the local dollar amount will be split between Republican and Democrat as in the past, correct? And is there going to be a cash portion as well?
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Representative Franzen, for the question. And so I think just regarding the timeline, we have shared this with Representative Erdahl too, and so this is not new information. I think regarding the size and scope of the bill, how the bill is made up, I think it really depends on an agreement that could be reached at the leadership level beyond, you know, what I could determine. I think at this point, I really want us to look at a bill in the range of 980 million GO. I know that in talking to Representative Erdahl, and it seems like that might not be the case. And then we also have to deal with the Senate too. You know, the Senate are operating under different terms. And so as of right now, it is my hope that, you know, with the timeline that we have in place, we could get agreement at the leadership level so that we could start having this discussion at the same starting point, so that we could, you know, talk about how much do we want to allocate for local projects, you know, what goes in or out of the bill regarding state agencies and whatnot. And so I think those are still ongoing, and I'm hopeful that, you know, we could come to an agreement, but if not, then I think the timeline that I will be working on is April 28th for DE posting, public comments on the 29th, and then roll out on the 1st.
Before we adjourn, we now have a quorum, so may I have a motion to approve the minutes for April 15th, 2024?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Scraba. Representative Scraven moves approval of the minutes for April 15th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The minutes for April 15th are approved. And with that, we are adjourned.